What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Monday, May 19th. The second round just wrapped up yesterday with a game seven and no games tonight, but the conference finals will kick off tomorrow evening. The four remaining teams, all really, really fun. Ton of parity across the NBA. We are set to have our seventh different champion in seven seasons, which I think is awesome. We had some pretty awesome series in the second round, some big individual performances, some just insane comebacks, some very close, fun, exciting games. And the conference finalists are set with the Pacers versus the Knicks and the Wolves versus the Thunder. I'm going to do a recap of just all of the four series that just wrapped up. Then I will do a conference finals sort of preview where I'll talk about some of the biggest question marks I have and things that could swing the matchup, as well as my predictions for each of the series. So with that being said, let's go ahead and get right into it. I'm going to start with the Thunder and Nuggets series, which wrapped up on Sunday afternoon, in which Oklahoma City very decisively knocked off the Nuggets in seven games. This was a tremendous series, so it's a little disappointing that Game 7 was not as competitive as some of the earlier games. It was more similar to Game 2, in which Oklahoma City also won that one by about 40 points. But this game, early on, a little bit of nerves for OKC coming out. It felt like this could be one of those scenarios where the more experienced team is a little bit more comfortable. You know, Denver got up by 10 points early, but Oklahoma City weathered the storm. It was a one-point game with about 3 minutes to go in the second, and OKC finished the half on an 18-5 run and really never looked back. And that was largely sparked by a big second quarter from Jalen Williams, who had been a big talking point to this series because he did not play super well throughout most of it, but obviously stepped up in the biggest moment. And that's really all that matters when we look back on this. But this was a great series, as I mentioned. It was, in my view, the best team versus the best player. And Jokic once again reminded us, you know, how great he is. He puts up 28, 14, and 6 averages on 48% from the field. And it kind of felt like it wasn't even a great Jokic series. So to have those kind of numbers, just he continues to just be such a dominant player. And honestly, probably the best player we've seen since prime LeBron at this point. I know we've had some other guys in the discussion for best player in the world since LeBron has declined a little bit, but I think Jokic is just so obviously pushing himself into that top 20, top 15 type territory. And if he was able to get this series win it and go on to the finals and God forbid even win the thing, it would be pretty hard to argue he's not in that top 10 range. But even with that, I think Oklahoma City did a really, really good job guarding him in this series. And that's one of the reasons why they were able to prevail. They kind of surprisingly started with Chet Holmgren guarding him to start the series in game one. And I think they quickly realized maybe that was not the best matchup. Jokic has a lot of pounds on him. And just when you've got Hartenstein out there, it made more sense to put him on there. So they eventually pivoted very quickly after that first game to Hartenstein guarding Jokic, and Chet as more of the roamer, kind of cheating off of Gordon from the corner, even though he was shooting the ball super well. But we saw the Timberwolves employ this strategy last season when they were able to knock off Denver also in seven games with the Gobert and Towns, with getting Towns' big body on Jokic, similar to Hartenstein, and then Gobert and Chet in that kind of roamer role, cheating off of the corner and Aaron Gordon in the dunker spot, wherever he's sitting in the court. But they really packed the paint on Jokic, and I thought it did bother him. I mean, the shooters around him were not making them pay. You know, last year we saw them do this similar strategy against Dallas. Obviously, totally different animal because Luka and Kyrie, more perimeter-oriented players. Jokic plays a lot in the paint. So they weren't packing the paint against those guys, but they were kind of cheating off of other guys onto them, doubling, making the role players beat them. And they did. And that was the problem. That's why they lost to Dallas last year, is because not because Luka had some great series, not because Kyrie went crazy, because PJ Washington shot out of his mind from the corner and Derek Jones Jr. shot well and all of their role players stepped up. Denver's were not able to do that. And so they gave the Thunder no reason to stop cheating off of those guys and going on to Jokic and packing that paint, like I mentioned. And it led to, this was the second lowest field goal percentage Jokic has had in a series in his career. The only lower one was in 2021 versus Suns when they got swept with no Jamal Murray and no Michael Porter Jr. So really tough supporting cast for him in that series. And this series, it was only 0.2 percentage points off of that. So pretty much right there for the lowest field goal percentage of his career in a series. In game two, he was 6-for-16. Game three, he was 8-for-25, including 0-of-10 from three. Game four, he was 7-for-22. So that's a three-game stretch where he was 21-for-63, which is 33% from the field. That's very un-Jokic-like. He's one of the most efficient players we've seen in NBA history, not just from a field goal percentage, but just in terms of efficiently generating good looks offensively. And he really struggled with the shot in a lot of this. And the other thing is, we've seen it be kind of a, in the past with him, a picker poison. You know, either he's going to distribute, get other guys going, or he's going to get his points. He wasn't getting his points in a lot of these games, but he also had the lowest assists per game in a series that he's had since 2022. Over his last seven series combined, he's averaged 9.4 assists per game in each of those series. This series, he had only 5.9. So a lot lower, like comfortably lower from where he's been. So a lot of that, you know, has to do with the fact that guys were not making shots. Michael Porter Jr., shell of himself. Murray was inconsistent. But regardless, he normally finds a way to get those guys good looks and get them involved. But he really struggled on that front as well. And he also had the second most total turnovers ever in a series for him. He had 6 in game 2, 7 in game 1, 8 in game 3. And Denver as a team overall averaged 18 turnovers a game. And OKC was plus 7 there. So that's been the formula for the Thunder really all season long. They had a historically great turnover differential this season. And their defense is it's insane. It's if they go, especially if they go on to win the finals this season, it'll probably be talked about as one of the greatest defenses ever. And I think rightfully so. I mean, you saw they had Jokic just smothered. Game 7, he couldn't even get the ball. I mean, Alex Caruso, of all people, was doing a phenomenal job denying the ball. I'm sure he got away with being probably a little extra physical, because I do think in today's modern NBA, when smaller players guard bigger players, they get a little bit more leeway because of the size disadvantage to be either more physical, or if the offensive player makes sometimes even just like a normal move, but the little guy falls over, they'll more likely to call that as an offensive foul. But overall, I do just want to give credit to Denver, because I know they lost the series, but this was more competitive than I thought. It went 7 games. I didn't think it would go that far. I did have it going 6, but even just how competitive each of the games were. Game 2 and Game 7 obviously were not, but all the other 5 games were extremely close. Could have been anyone's game down the stretch. And that's just really impressive for I've talked all year about how just insanely good this Oklahoma City team is, especially on the defensive end, but 68 wins, one of the best net ratings in NBA history, top 2 all time. So for a team in Denver to have this significant of a talent disadvantage and depth and all of those things to still take this team 7 games, I thought it was really impressive, to the point where I was almost like, look, if they can somehow make it out of this series and they stay relatively healthy, I was almost tempted to say that I think the winner of this series was going to go on to win the whole thing. And like I said, even in a, you know, not great Jokic series, he still had insane numbers. He still had a just masterclass Game 5 with 44-15 on 17-25 shooting. But that game, and it was in a nutshell why they couldn't win this series. In the fourth quarter of that game, Jokic had 13 points on 4-of-6 shooting. The entire rest of the team had 6 points on 1-of-15. And the one was a garbage time layup, basically as the time was expiring. So for as long as that game was in question, his teammates were 0-of-14 from the field in that fourth quarter. And that is just in a nutshell why they were not able to win this series, because they didn't, I mean, they had 4-ish guys they could trust. Like Michael Porter Jr. was, I'm sure there's going to be something that comes out that said he was playing very injured, but 7 points per game on 32% from the field, 25% from three. If he's not scoring and not shooting, he just does not offer enough else out there on the court. He's a defensive liability often, but they couldn't really bench him because they didn't have any other options. I mean, Jamal Murray was not great, 21 points on 41% from the field. Christian Brown, a little inconsistent, only shot 28% from three, 41% from the field. Russ was just awful. I'll say this. I think the Clippers series, Russ deserves a ton of credit. I do not think they win that series without some really big plays from him. And just he had his head scratching moments like he always does, but he was really consistently solid. I thought he was a swing piece in that series, and he was a swing piece the other way in this series. He shot 35% from the field, 22% from three. They were a minus 27 net rating when he was on the court in this series. So they were just getting absolutely demolished in the Russ minutes. I mean, they're late in some of these games. He's airballing three pointers that aren't even close. So this was really not a good Russ series. But again, just like Porter Jr., they had no choice but to play him because they didn't have any other bodies. Like Strother obviously was massive for them down the stretch in game six, but he didn't do much else otherwise. He's still a bit of a liability defensively. And then Peyton Watson can make some good defensive plays here and there, but he's pretty much a zero on the offensive end. And then Adelman really didn't explore many of the other players off the bench like Jalen Pickett or anything like that. And I don't blame him. You know, this just isn't a deep team. And like I said, the fact they were even able to get here was really impressive in my opinion. I actually thought Adelman did a really good job coaching wise to take this game, this team seven games. He mixed in that zone defense, which I thought really bothered the Thunder. I don't know if they were just not really expecting it, hadn't really gone against a lot of zone this year. But Denver was not a great defensive team all year long, but they really, really made it difficult for the Thunder, especially in the half court, you know, sort of bailing out on SGA, bailing out on Jalen Williams, making some of the other guys beat them. And I actually thought the role players for OKC played pretty well overall, but it's still down the stretch of these games. It felt like it was difficult for them to get buckets sometimes, but the problem is it was the same for Denver. You know, both of these teams were kind of not exactly offensive juggernauts through most of the series, but I do think OKC really needed this series. And in a way, I feel like it going seven is good for them as opposed to if they had just cruised in a five game series, which I felt was certainly possible coming into the series. But I think that it was really the first series where they beat a really legitimately good proven team. And in this case, a championship level team in Denver who won the title just 2 years ago. Before this, they had only beaten Memphis this season, who obviously was playing their worst basketball of the season and just not a very good team. And then last year when they beat the Pelicans without Zion Williamson, so compromised version of that team as well. But this was their first real test that they passed. You know, last year they lose to Dallas in round two. That was their first time in the postseason with this core. And for a lot of these players, first time in the postseason at all. So it's not really surprising they lost second round. I picked Dallas in that series. I thought that experience would win out. But this was a series where they grew up because a lot of the worries for this group were about, in crunch time, can they get big buckets outside of SGA? And he played at an MVP level, 30 points per game, 7-6 on 53% from the field. He was every bit as awesome as you could have hoped, and he hit some really big shots in late in a lot of these games. But they also got some really big contributions from some key role guys. I thought Kayson Wallace really helped swing game four. He hit a couple of big threes in that fourth quarter that they really needed to clinch that one. Lu Dort in game five, they do not win that game without him. He hit three threes on four possessions in the middle part of that fourth quarter, which was huge because they were really scuffling a bit offensively during that part of the game. Caruso, huge in game seven, had some big games throughout the series, but he guarded Jokic and it worked. You know, that was the biggest adjustment that they made in that game seven. And I don't think Denver saw it coming. And Caruso's been one of the best undersized players guarding bigger guys in the league for a while now, but Jokic is a whole other ask, you know, and he really held in there. And those guys all shot well for the most part. You know, Wallace was 38% from three, Caruso 43%. Dort didn't shoot super well, but obviously did make some timely shots, as I mentioned. But in clutch time in this series, Oklahoma City was a plus 2.3 in the clutch in this series, which doesn't sound like that's not a huge net rating, obviously. But Denver, I mean, just 2 years ago, even last year, this is the team that we always talked about as like in a close game, they just win those games. They are the team that if it's close, Jokic is going to make enough plays, Murray's going to hit enough shots, and they're going to find a way to win. And OKC had been kind of getting the rep of the opposite of that, where they had so many blowouts this season that they maybe weren't adjusted to playing in these situations, especially in the playoffs. And they lost a lot of those games last year against Dallas in the same setting. But this year, look, game one was really bad. I talked about that on my last pod. You know, they were up 13 with 6 minutes to go. They're up 9 with 3 minutes to go. They totally blew that game. Chet misses 2 free throws down the stretch. Their foul 3 strategy is just horribly backfires. They have some turnovers late, and that was bad. And then game three, they were outscored 11-2 in overtime, so that wasn't great either. But as the series went on, they got more and more comfortable in those situations. Game four, they were down 8 early in the fourth quarter, and they finished the game on a 29-16 run to win that one. Game five, they're down 9 early in the fourth quarter. They finished the game on a 31-15 run. And in that game, they were tied at 103 with a minute 20 left and finished the game on a 10-2 run. So they had some really big moments down the stretch of some of these clutch time games, which I think they really needed, especially against a team like Denver, to prove not only to us, but to themselves that they can win those games. Because it is a process as a young team to be able to get to a point where you're comfortable in those situations against an experienced team. I do still think there certainly are some question marks about Oklahoma City. You know, the Chet and J-Dub as secondary options for them, I don't think they really disproved a lot of those doubts in this series. Obviously, Jalen Williams was spectacular in game seven, as I mentioned. But if you look at just the other swing games in the series, if you take out game two and game seven, which were blowouts, which they probably could have won even if he didn't play super well just because the team played so well. He was great in game three. I'll give him that. 32 points on 11 for 21. But game one, he was 5 for 20, and they lose that one in clutch time. Game four, 2 for 13, and they win that one, but not because him. Game five, 5 for 14. And again, they win that one, but it was more in spite of him. Game six, 3 for 16 from the field, and they lose that one as well. So in those four games, he went 15 for 63, which is 24% from the field. Like I said, he stepped up in game seven, but it is fair to say that he did not have a good series overall. He just did not shoot the ball well. And I don't really think it's anything Denver did crazy to guard him. I thought he was getting pretty good looks. I thought he was fine as a initiator on the offense. It's not like he was being suffocated. He just didn't make shots that he's made a lot of those all year. And so the doubts are going to remain, because if they lost this series, it was really going to be a tough offseason for him. And I think that they were going to have to look themselves in the mirror and think, is this the guy that we think he can be? I know he's still super young and it's kind of unfair, but those shooting numbers are alarming, and it's the second year in a row, especially in the second round, where he just didn't have it more often than he did. And then Chet, it's not like Chet was awful. I mean, 14 and 11, 46% from the field for the series, 22% from three, so didn't shoot well from there. Missed those big free throws that cost them game one. Again, he was fine. Good defensively, so was J-Dub. But the hope is that when J-Dub didn't have good games, the Chet can step up. And he didn't really do that a ton either. And so the two of these guys, they're both going to be question marks for the team moving forward. We know what we're getting from SGA. We know how suffocating their defense is across the board. And the role guys, for the most part, contributed as expected, if not better than you could have hoped for. But they made it through the series. And so the question marks will loom, but they'll have more opportunity to, you know, disprove that narrative as the number two guy. And for OKC, just bigger picture here, they needed to win this series, because if they had lost, it would have been really bad. It would have been back-to-back second round exits as the number one seed in the Western Conference. This time, a resounding number one seed with 68 wins. As I mentioned, one of the best point differentials and net ratings of all time. And the reality is that nobody would have trusted them moving forward. It would have been one of those where they're frauds until proven otherwise. And I'm not saying I agree with that necessarily, because they are still super young, but the reality is that that's just what it would have been. That's how the media would have reacted next year when they're the number one seed again. If that's the case, nobody was going to be like, I think this is the year for OKC. People were going to be like, they'll probably lose again second round, because J-Dub's not going to step up. Chet's not going to pick up for him. And until they either add somebody or prove us wrong, I'm going to keep doubting them. And those would have been relatively fair takes to have. But even just winning this series, even if they go on to lose in the conference finals or just not win the whole thing, at the very least, you can point to linear progression. You know, last year you lose second round. This year, you at least made the conference finals. So you can spin it positively, even if they don't win the title, having won the series. They finally knocked off another really good, like, borderline contender team, which they hadn't done in the past. So we checked that box as well. But this series was a must have. It was going to be a long offseason for this group if they didn't win it. And then just wrapping up with Denver moving forward, like, where do they go from here? This is clearly a very, very flawed roster, a very, very flawed team. They are just getting bailed out by Jokic. I said this in my podcast about when Mike Malone was fired. This franchise has been questionably run, in my opinion, in the sense that they are not doing everything they can to maximize Jokic's prime. And they have put them in a position where they don't even have a lot of options. Like, you cannot have 5 to 6 playable guys in the playoffs. You need more bodies than that. And they've let productive role players walk away for nothing. They have not backfilled them well with their draft picks outside of Christian Brown. You can't have your $40 million a year player, Michael Porter Jr., averaging 7 points per game and being a liability on the defensive end of the court. You need to, you know, try to maximize what you can out of Jokic's prime, because we don't know how many years this guy's left. Windows close quickly, and you've got a window with Jokic, and in my opinion, they're just not doing what they can to maximize it. And so if I'm them, I'm willing to trade Michael Porter Jr. I'm willing to, you know, stay in the second apron, trade away all the picks remaining that I possibly can to try to make something of an upgrade for this roster, because it's really just a shame that another year of Jokic just doing pretty much everything humanly possible without any sort of support whatsoever. So moving over to the other series that wrapped up over the weekend, in which the Knicks defeated the Celtics in game 6 in a game that was pretty much over before halftime. The Celtics just ran out of juice without Tatum. And I don't think it's overly surprising, but this was such a huge statement series for the Knicks. I know that, you know, Boston wasn't necessarily fully healthy, but the Knicks deserved this series. I thought that they had a really good game plan coming into it that worked really well. There's been countless questions about New York's defense all season long. They had that stretch during the middle part of the year where they were among the league's worst defensive teams for a pretty big stretch there. And that's always kind of been a question for a team that's got Karl Anthony Towns as its center. You've got Jalen Brunson, a smaller player who's already doing so much on offense. It's hard for him to compete there all the time. But I thought that they won this series with defense, and especially their approach on that end, where they were switching everything. And it really baited Boston into a lot of isolation ball. They were so focused on attacking mismatches, but they didn't do it effectively. They settled in those situations. They weren't getting downhill to the basket. They were settling for threes. And the problem when you're so reliant on those three-pointers is that when they're not going down, it's really hard to win games. And that's pretty much what happened for Boston for the most of the part of this series. And it took away their ball movement. And it just led to that poor shooting. And so I think New York, their strategy on that end was executed perfectly. I think another reason they were able to win this series was because for the first time really in the Brunson era in New York, it didn't feel like they were crazy relying on him offensively. You know, he had some big games, but he wasn't the only source of offense for this group. Like last year, for example, his usage percentage in the playoffs was 36%, which led all of the NBA. In the first round this year, it was 34%. This series, it was below 30%. So you could see a more concerted effort on the Knicks front to get other guys involved and not have Brunson have to do everything. And that was, I mean, one of my biggest criticisms of the Knicks after the Pistons series was like, look, if they're going to play this way, they're not going to go very far. I mean, it felt like in the half court, they have no plan B. It's like, please go bail us out, Jalen Brunson. We'll keep the game close and then you'll win it for us late. But, and of course, he did a lot of those things in the series, but it wasn't so overly reliant like it's been in the past. And this series was sort of a culmination of what I think this front office's vision was when they went out and essentially went all in on this group. Brunson, like I said, led the way, 26 a game, 7 assists, 45% from the field, 39% from three. It wasn't some crazy Brunson series. We've seen him be more dominant than he was in this series, but as I said, I think that's a good thing. I think it's good that he didn't have to carry this team. He did for stretches, and that's perfectly fine. That's what you want out of your star player. But to have to do it for 48 minutes every single night, it's not sustainable. It's why New York ran out of gas last postseason and why they're still playing this year. So he still had those takeover moments like game four when he had that big third quarter, which that might have been the series right there. If Boston wins that, if Tatum obviously doesn't get hurt, it's 2-2 headed back to Boston. And I think almost everybody's looking at it like, I think the Celtics are in a good position to come back and win this thing. But he clutched up and won them that game. And that's the kind of thing you need out of him. But it just not having to have him do it all the time was really big. And a big part of why he didn't have to is because guys like Mikal Bridges, who I felt like they finally properly used him as a secondary creator after Brunson. All year long, it's felt like he's just been trying to fit in and it's been a little awkward. And on paper, the fit makes a ton of sense when they added him, but it felt like he was underutilized. Even towards the end of his tenure in Phoenix and then obviously in Brooklyn, we had seen him expand his game to be a guy who can run the pick and roll, who can generate his own offense, score out of the mid-range. We know he can shoot from the corners. Like he's a guy that is able to generate offense all on his own. And they just didn't ask him to do that very much this year. And so it felt kind of like a disappointing year for him across the board. But I thought in this series, it was the best that he's looked as a Knick, especially on the offensive end, but also on the defensive end. He was really clutch down the stretch of some of these big games. In the fourth quarter of game two, he had 14 points on 6-10 shooting. And they don't make that comeback without those buckets. That really is what ignited that run to get them back in the game. Game four, he had 10 points on 5-6 shooting. So he was the early fourth quarter when Brunson's on the bench. Let's run the offense through Bridges. And it worked, and it was great. But I also thought he played the best defense he's played as a Knick. I mean, he had basically back-to-back game-clinching defensive plays in game one and game two. And I thought he just did a much better job on Boston's guards than he has really a lot of the whole season. Easy to forget that this guy was second in defensive player of the year for Phoenix not that long ago. And so he left a lot to be desired on that end this year, but I think he's back to playing maybe not defensive player of the year type defense, but at least getting closer to where he was in the past, and they're getting more involved offensively. So was he worth 5-6 picks? I don't know about that, but you know, if they go on to make the finals, I don't think too many people are going to be upset that they did that because he's been a huge part of this. So credit to him in that front office. And then OG Anunoby, he had some big games. You know, he's been up and down. It's kind of the story of his career, but 29 points in game one, in which he was arguably the best player on the court, and they don't win that game without every last one of those buckets out of him. He was great defensively, as he is every year and every series. Karl Anthony Towns, he did not shoot super well in this series, but I thought he actually held up really well defensively, and that's where I'm going to give him his kudos. Is like I said, they're switching a lot, and he was able to hold up and not be this defensive liability that the joke in the past has been, like pick and roll a cat every single time. And that was not a strategy that worked, and he held up there. I think it's a little concerning his lack of involvement shooting a little bit in this series, but I thought when they did go to him as like a post scorer, it was really effective, especially on the Boston bigs. Like he was just destroying Horford down there. I don't know why they didn't go to that a little bit more, but it's at least a wrinkle in their offense that we know is clearly there. And I think he's an underrated scorer in the posts. And it just felt like they should maybe try that a little bit more. And maybe they will against Indiana, who's not an overly big team, especially with their backup big spot as one of the weaker parts of the roster. So we'll see if they utilize that. But I think the big swing player in this series was Mitchell Robinson. He was just a massive difference maker. As the year went by, people started to get a little lukewarm on them. Like maybe we overestimated where they could be, but I always said, look, if Mitchell Robinson comes back fully healthy in the postseason, I believe he can be a huge difference maker for this team, because we saw Towns look at his best, at least on the defensive end, next to Rudy Gobert in Minnesota. And playing those two next to each other, Robinson and Towns in New York, is basically a light version of that. Robinson is obviously not Rudy Gobert as a defender or a player, but his defensive impact in this series was extremely noteworthy. He was they were a plus 18 net rating when he was on the court. No other Knicks starter in the series was better than even plus one. So he was far and away the most impactful player from a net rating perspective. like I said, he was huge defensively. He held up really well on switches. Like when Tatum was trying to switch him onto him as the ball handler, he didn't allow him to get to the basket, made him settle for outside jump shots. There was a play in game six where he's out there guarding the perimeter, switches onto four different guys, gets into the corner, traps Jaylen Brown and forces a steal. And it's like, that is just in a nutshell, him in this series and the impact that he had. He's also obviously a great rebounder. And I don't think that they necessarily win this series if he doesn't play as well as he did. And I mean, Joe Mazzulla was fouling just to get him out of the game. And he even admitted it, that he had been killing them. So it was very apparent how dominant he had been, especially on the defensive end. And then Deuce McBride was solid across the board. And then Josh Hart was kind of the glue that held it all together. I thought he did a really good job on both ends. And Boston's strategy was to put the big man on Hart so that they couldn't run the pick and roll with the big on Towns. And so they did a lot of screens with Hart instead, and that still worked really well. So they could get the big onto the ball handler, and Hart was great in that short role. He hit enough shots from outside. He does a lot of the little things, and just a winning player across the board, as we saw in the playoffs for him last year. Another big thing, I thought Tibbs really outcoached Mazzulla on this one. And I don't know if I would have predicted that coming, because I've come around quite a bit on Mazzulla. I was very skeptical of him in his first year after Boston lost in the conference finals to Miami. But last year, I thought he was just phenomenal across the board. And this year, I thought he did a really good job as well. But I didn't love everything in this series. I thought the offense lacked a lot of creativity. It lacked ball movement. They settled a lot. I thought Peyton Pritchard was a little underutilized. He was one of the players who's a little bit more effective attacking some of those mismatches. And I just didn't think they adjusted very well across the board. And I thought Tibbs, like I said, I mean, their defensive schemes were some of the best I've seen against Boston by any team in a while. And it made them uncomfortable, and credit to, you know, Thibodeau, because that's his bread and butter, is the defensive end of the court. And I thought that they were a little bit more creative offensively than we've seen them been in the past. So credit to them. But the reality is that Boston, they lost this series in the first two games. They were the first team to blow 20-plus point leads in back-to-back playoff games ever. Game one, they were up 72-52 at the six-minute mark in the third quarter. Knicks go on a 48-28 run to end regulation and then win it in overtime. Game two, they're down almost identical score, 73-53 at the three-minute mark of the third quarter. They go on a 38-17 run to end the game and win by 1 point. And then game four, they are down 72-58 at the nine-minute mark of the third quarter. They go on a 30-13 run to end that third quarter and then end up extending that lead up to double digits in the fourth quarter. So those three games were obviously the swing games here. And I think Boston wins those games more often than they don't in just this era of basketball. But it was really weird to see them look so uncomfortable down the stretch in some of these games. Like, they had a 50 offensive rating in the clutch in this series. They were a -68.5. This is a team that was dominant in the clutch last season, especially in the postseason, where they just, you get a close game and they were going to win it every time. So a 50 offensive rating, that is like not a real number. That's how bad and how low that is. So, but they couldn't make shots. New York made them uncomfortable. And obviously they didn't shoot well, especially in those first two games, 15-60 from three in game one, 10-40 in game two. So 25-100 in the first two games. They broke the record for most missed threes in a playoff game in game one. They choked this away. I mean, the thing is, as much as I praise the Knicks, they didn't play some flawless series. Like, this was there for them to take. Karl Anthony Towns made only 3 three-pointers all series long. 3 in 6 games. If I told you that, I don't think a lot of people would have thought the Knicks would have had a chance. I mean, Anunoby, great game one, like I mentioned, had a good game four as well. But you look at some of the other games. Game two, 5 points on 2 of 9. Game three, 2 points on 1 of 6. Game five, 6 points on 1 of 12. Like, he had some stinkers in this one. A lot of those were swing games as well. Mikal Bridges, for as great as he was down the stretch, he was 9-31. In game one and two, those two very important swing games. So he also wasn't great early. And so it just felt like this was so self-inflicted by Boston. If they just try to get a little bit more ball movement going in some of those early games, just make a few more extra shots. I mean, if they even make one or two extra threes in those first two games, they probably win both of them. They really do. And so I'm not taking away from New York. Like I said, I thought their game plan was great and they executed when it mattered most, but it did really feel like Boston could have and should have won this. Even aside from the Tatum injury, like there's a world where Boston's up 3-0 in this. And then even with the Tatum injury, which who knows, if it probably wouldn't have happened because things just play out, butterfly effect. But even if it did still happen, they still probably win the series in that scenario. And just to put it into perspective, they, excluding game six, which obviously was a huge blowout for the Knicks, the Celtics led for 213 out of 245 possible minutes in the series in games one through five. The Knicks led for only 32 minutes and they went 3-2 in those games. So the Knicks just outplayed them down the stretch. Boston kind of shot themselves in the foot. And even with all that, it kind of felt like Boston still maybe would have had a chance if Tatum hadn't gotten hurt. You know, I think if they're down 3-1, headed back to Boston, I mean, they won game five anyway. If you're going to game six down 3-2 and Tatum's healthy, we've seen Boston play their best with their back against the wall. We've seen them be arguably a better road team than a home team in the postseason over this era of Celtics basketball. And even the Vegas adjusted odds had them like pretty much even odds to still win the series after it was basically 3-1. So I still think they would have had a chance, but once Tatum went down, it was going to be such an uphill battle, but they weren't whole. Porzingis was completely, utterly unplayable. He was a shell of himself. He was terrible on both ends of the court, getting torched defensively, just completely ineffective offensively, couldn't get to his spots, wasn't knocking down shots. I mean, he averaged 4 points a game in 16 minutes. He shot only 6-for-25 from the field. That's 24%. They were a minus 13 net rating when he was on the court. And he, like I said, he was just getting killed on both ends of the court. So, I mean, credit to Mazzulla for, you know, especially in that game five, just rolling with Kornet, who obviously had a huge game. But Porzingis was just unrecognizable in this series. And then Drew Holiday and Al Horford looked old. I mean, they're pretty old. Horford's up there getting close to 40. Drew Holiday's 34 years old. And I think especially with Drew, the thought all season, he looked a little like step slow through a lot of the regular season. They were easing him in, resting him in games. And I think the thought was, well, they're saving him for the playoffs. You know, they already got their title. They're going to take the regular season a little less seriously, rest some of their older guys. And the hope was that he would turn it up come playoff time. And he never really did. He just didn't. So it begs the question, is he just a little over the hump now? And he was great for them in the playoff run last year. He was huge, super efficient. You know, they don't win as easily. I won't say they don't win without him playing like that, but they don't win as easily and cruise to that title without his play. There was talks of him being in the discussion for finals MVP. That's how good he was. And he was great in the conference finals as well. But 9 points per game, only 7.5 field goal attempts. That's just not enough. When Tatum's down like that, Porzingis is unplayable. Like, he's got to be more aggressive, and he just wasn't able to do anything offensively, really. And then Al Horford, they were a minus 5.8 with him on the court. He's kind of been their saving grace and their Porzingis insurance over the last few years. But that insurance policy looked like it was running up because he just wasn't very effective. He didn't really make shots from outside. He defensively, he's just a lot more easy to attack than he used to be. And he's just a body out there. He's a smart player still. And he's not totally, totally washed, but he's not a guy at this point that you can just count on for 35 plus minutes in a high leverage playoff game. Sam Hauser obviously missed a few games and then Tatum was out. So it was not a whole version of this Boston team. It was a compromised version of what we've seen them be. I don't say any of that to take away from the Knicks. I think they fully earned this series. There's no sort of asterisk on the series, in my opinion, because Tatum, when he went down, it was already 3-1. I think Boston could have come back, but to expect that, it's really unfair to just assume that would happen. But obviously, the greatest consequence of this series for Boston is not that they lost in the second round. It's that Jason Tatum has a torn Achilles, and he's probably not going to play a single minute of basketball next season. And that's a really tough reality for this team because there had been rumors already for months, honestly, that Boston was going to be in talks to shake their roster up a little bit. And guys like Kristaps Porzingis and Jrue Holiday were certainly going to be on the table potentially to cut some salary because they are deep into the second apron. And just with the way that the new CBA is, it's really difficult to stay in that second apron for multiple years. You kind of have to every couple of years reset yourself, or else you put yourself in position to potentially have your draft pick pushed back to 30th in the first round, 7 years out, which is just a killer penalty, not to mention just the general inflexibility that the second apron brings a team, because you can't aggregate salaries. You can't sign anyone to anything but the minimum. There's just a lot of things that make roster building more difficult. And so with Kristaps Porzingis having 1 year left at around $30 million for next year, Jrue Holiday with 3 years, a little over $100 million, it makes sense that one of those guys might go. And I think that they were probably going to do it anyway. But with the Tatum news, it makes it, I think, increasingly more likely, because I don't doubt they could still make the playoffs next year without Tatum, but they are not sniffing contention. They are not a championship caliber team without him. He is the heart and soul of this team. He has made all NBA first team, I think, four straight seasons. I think it's going to be five after they announce it this year. He is their leading scorer, their leading playmaker and assist guy, their most versatile defender, probably. He's been an Iron Man as well. I mean, he hasn't missed more than 10 games in a season in his entire career. And so they are just not going to be able to survive life without him next season. And so I think it's likely they view it as a throwaway year. And I think that it's likely that one or both of Holiday or Porzingis get moved. I can't totally rule out them moving Jaylen Brown. I think that would maybe be a little unnecessary. And I think they'd be pretty hesitant. They'd have to get some huge package and be all bought in. But I also think the new ownership thing complicates things a little bit, because, I mean, just with how many new owners we've had recently that have made big moves that didn't land so well with their teams, for them to come in and immediately trade Jaylen Brown, it feels like a risky PR move. But it probably would be, from a financial perspective, an okay decision. But they have other avenues to, you know, cut that salary. And so it's really just a tale of the how short windows are in the modern NBA. I mean, I talked about this with Denver a little bit. It's fair to wonder if their window is basically closed unless they start to make some drastic moves. Boston, five conference finals in the last, I guess, 8 years now it is, a couple finals appearances, champions last year. And if you were drafting teams a month ago to say whose next 3-4 years would you want to take, I think probably you have Oklahoma City first, but Boston is probably right there next. And just like that, after this, they might not even be in the top half, because Tatum's everything. It's the prime of his career, and you don't know how he's going to come back. You hope that it's his same all-NBA level self, but the Achilles is it's a tough injury. And we saw KD come back and look basically just as good. We saw Klay come back and not look as good. Of course, he also had the ACL, but the point is, history says it's a mixed bag. And so you hope that he comes back. He's a little younger than some of these other guys that have had them, but there's just no guarantees. And with how this roster could need to be shaken up to cut some salary for next year, they are in a very uncertain place. And the hope is that maybe you shed some salary this year, you retool with some maybe slightly younger, cheaper players for next year. And then the year after, when Tatum is back, that is when you really go for it again. But again, that's easier said than done. And especially with the inflexibility they currently have, they do have draft picks to play with as well, but we'll see. But it is a tale of how short windows last in the modern NBA. So take advantage of them while you have them. I'm looking at you, teams like you, the Knicks. This is your opportunity to go for it now. And this, I mean, it's true for the Pacers, for the Wolves, for all these teams. Because you could be Boston next year. One bad injury for Brunson, then suddenly now you're paying Mikal Bridges another deal, and Kat's making 70 plus mil, and all the flexibility's gone, and you have to make some tough decisions. Moving to the other East series, the Pacers and Cavs, it was a bummer. Obviously, injuries certainly did factor into this a little bit. I mean, Garland was hobbled all series with that toe.
Only averaged 14 a game, 34% from the field, was clearly a little compromised, 3-for-18 from three in the series. Mitchell, by the end of the series with that ankle, had almost no lift, could not hit anything from deep, only 12-for-49 from three in the series. That's 25%, but obviously still played well overall. I mean, 34 points a game. And then Mobley and Hunter both missed a game, but I'm not here to make excuses. You know, I thought Indiana deserved every bit of this to, you know, go into Cleveland and win the way they did in some of those games and to destroy them the way they did in game four. Like, they kicked their ass in this series. They just did. I'm not saying that they for sure win as convincingly if all those guys are 100% healthy, but Indiana is damn good. And I'm not going to sit here and say that they didn't deserve this or that this is an injury asterisk type series, because they kicked their ass. And the biggest story for Indiana is that they never die. I keep saying this, but they are never out of a game, no matter how big of a deficit they're in. They are a plus 54 net rating in the playoffs and clutch time so far this postseason. They were a plus 128 in this series. So in clutch time, they are just locked in on both ends of the court, particularly on the offensive end. They've had some ridiculous numbers and some comebacks. I mean, game one, Cavs had the lead with 7 minutes to go. Pacers outscored them 20-10 the rest of the way to clinch that one. Game two, they're down 7 with 47 seconds to go. The second time they pulled off a comeback in that short amount of time in this playoffs after doing it against Milwaukee as well. Then game five, down 19 with 8 minutes to go in the second quarter. And it never, they didn't panic. They never felt like they were out of it. They chip away. They immediately go on a 27-9 run. Opened up the third quarter on a 28-8 run after the first two Cavs buckets, and they never really looked back after that either. And so it just feels like they're never out of a game, and they're just so dangerous in any series against any team. They play to their competition, which can be bad sometimes in a long regular season, but come postseason time, it feels like they're not scared of anybody. They didn't, even though last year they got swept by Boston, obviously Halliburton got hurt. But they were in all of those games. They were right there. It was a very close and competitive sweep. And Halliburton just continues to control the game, just really unlike almost anyone. I mean, I'll take Jokic over him in that capacity. But in terms of just generating offense and good looks, manipulating the defense, just a dominant passer, playmaker, his stats aren't sexy. You know, he only had 17-7 averages in the series, but he shot the hell out of the ball, 54% from the field, 46% from three. And then the eye test is just that, one, he makes clutch plays when he needs them, and two, he can turn it on and be as dominant as anyone on the offensive end when he's feeling it. But what's so great about Indiana is that they're not hugely Halliburton reliant. He's such a unique guy where most players like him that control the game the way they do are really ball dominant guys. And he's not, even the leader in usage rate on the team this season. That was Siakam actually. And so yeah, they just come at you in so many ways. They play with awesome pace, but they're still really good in the half court offense with their ball movement, their player movement. They cut, they keep defenses moving. They make you work. They make you stay engaged because if you're sleeping for half a second, they're going to rotate and find the open guy. They have a deep rotation. They play 10 guys, 10 plus minutes in this series, which I mean, you look at like Denver and they're just struggling to trot six guys out there. Meanwhile, Carlisle is playing 10 guys in the first quarter, which is just like pretty unheard of in the postseason at this point. But it's hard not to because they're all playing so well. 8 out of the 10 players that played 10 plus minutes in the series shot 50% or better from the field and 40% or better from three. As a team, they shot 50-40 throughout this whole playoffs, throughout this series. They did the same thing last year too. Like just some of these shooting percentages. I mean, even just from three, Halliburton 46%, Siakam 44%, Turner 56%, Nembhard 50%, who by the way, Andrew Nembhard is sneakily the second all-time leader in postseason history in three-point percentage. Just something to note. Nesmith, 45% from three. Mathurin, 41% from three. Shepherd, 44% from three. Thomas Bryant, 67% from three. TJ McConnell, 50% from three. So Toppin is the only guy in the rotation who's not hitting 40% of his threes in this series. And I wish you could say this is like an outlier, like, oh, they're not going to shoot that well again. Well, they did it all last postseason, and they're doing it all again this postseason. So the sample size is creeping up to be quite big enough to say that they just got a lot of guys that can hit a lot of shots in the biggest moments. And their offense is just such a dynamic unit. And the other part of this is that they're way improved defensively from last season. I've been seeing this for a while. Since their 10 and 15 start in the regular season, they were 7th in defensive rating over that span. They're 48 and 19 record-wise. That's a 67-game sample, almost a full season of playing near 60-win pace. In the playoffs, they're 2nd in offensive rating, 7th in defensive rating, but where their defensive rating is would fall into 9th during the regular season. So they've maintained a top 10 defense and that level into the postseason as well. And so they are a force to be reckoned with. They are to be taken seriously. You can argue all you want that the conference finals was a fluke last year, but you do it 2 years in a row, and I'm just not really buying that it's an accident. You know, it's really hard to make it one time. Just ask Joel Embiid. Ask Donovan Mitchell how hard it is to make the conference finals. So to do it 2 years in a row, I know it took some luck, but every deep run ever takes luck. You know, it's just part of attrition is a huge part of the NBA postseason, unfortunately. And we saw a lot of injuries this year. We saw a lot of injuries last year. That's just how the modern NBA is. And it's not like the Pacers didn't have their own fair share of injuries last year. And this year, to an extent, I mean, their whole backup center rotation didn't make it through the first month of the season. But on the Cavs side of things, even with the health stuff, they looked broken. It just, all of my fears with Cleveland came to fruition in this series. I have been on this soapbox for a little bit now about how, look, this is great in the regular season. I want to see it in the postseason before I fully get there, before I really trust them. In the playoffs, they just dismantled Miami, but I think that was more of an indictment on the Heat than it was anything meaningful for Cleveland. And I picked Indiana in this series because I had all these doubts about them. And this Cleveland core has now had 5 playoff series together. The Miami series is really the only one that they've looked good, looked comfortable, looked like how they look in the regular season. This series was a lot of the same of what we've seen in the past, where guys just aren't playing to the level that they were before. And you just look at some of their role players that they just didn't make the shots that they did all year. You know, Max Strus was 34% in this series after 39% in the regular season. Ty Jerome, 25% in this series after 44% in the regular season. DeAndre Hunter, 31% in this series after 43% in the regular season with the Cavs. Sam Merrill, 33% in this series, 37% regular season. Dean Wade, 20% from three in this series, 36% in the regular season. I mean, they were 29% from three as a team in this series after being 2nd in the NBA at 38% on the year. And Jared Allen, you know, the lights were a little brighter than I expected meme is fully fair to bring back. It's not like he was terrible, but it's just like, again, he's just not as impactful as he was in the regular season. They just don't have the same spacing with him out there that a lot of these teams do because he can't stretch the floor and he's got Mobley next to him. And then, you know, defensively, he's still solid, but a team like Indiana was able to pick them apart. And that was one of the biggest problems for the Cavs in this series is that in the regular season, they had 112 defensive rating, which was 8th in the NBA. In the playoffs, it was 117, which was dead last among all of the second round teams. And the playoff average is 113. So they were just not good defensively in this series. Again, I touched on how Garland just, I think it's a little unfair to judge his play necessarily, but he really, really did not shoot the ball well in this one. I know that toe was bothering him, but again, the sample size starts to get bigger and we start to see like how many years can we give someone the benefit of the doubt, because Garland hasn't played particularly well in some of these other series they've had also. And then just obviously Donovan Mitchell, he had big numbers in this series and they probably don't even win a game without him. He was big for them in this series, obviously, but he was a little too big for them. You know, all year Cleveland had great ball movement. It was a by committee approach offensively. We talked all season about how Donovan Mitchell willingly took a little bit of a step back to let the other guys cook a little bit and get the role players involved. And just not be so reliant on him. But this series, he went right back to being the ISO hero ball Mitchell that we've seen at his worst in some of these playoff runs. And to his defense, it's not really that fair, because he probably felt like he had to with Garland banged up and then Mobley missed a game. And like I said, the role guys weren't hitting shots, but he had a 41% usage rate in this series, which was the highest of any series of his career. And we've seen a lot of very heavy Mitchell playoff series in the past. This was the number one most involved Mitchell series. He's 37% for the playoffs in this playoff run, which is a top 20 usage percentage in playoff history for a playoff run. So it was just entirely too much Donovan Mitchell. It's just not sustainable to when you start to play like legitimately good teams. And if you just look at those top 20 usage in playoff history, 13 of the 20 of those guys lost in the first round. 17 of the 20 lost by round two. The only to make it beyond MJ, LeBron, and Luka. So the two greatest players of all time, and Luka, who's up there for one of the greatest playoff performers that we've ever seen. And then 18 of 20 lost before the finals. So Luka gets removed from that. And basically, you have to be a top two player of all time to be able to make that deep of a run and have that sort of usage rate. And so Mitchell is not close to that, obviously. During the regular season, his usage was 31%, which was the lowest he had had since 2020. So, yes, Cleveland was banged up. Yes, their role players didn't hit shots. But I think the biggest reason they lost is they got away from what got them there. All year long, they were a ball movement team, a get everybody involved, a by committee offense. And they immediately reverted back to all of Mitchell's worst habits as a player. And look, Mitchell is really good. Don't get me wrong. I think he's a top 15 player in the league right now. But his track record is starting to not look very good. We know he's had some insane playoff highs. He's also had some really low playoff moments. And he's now 4-8 in playoff series. He has never made the conference finals at 28 years old. The only teams he's beaten those four series were a 37-win Heat team this year, a Orlando Magic team that was led by a second-year 21-year-old Paolo Banchero, really had no business winning that series, an 8-seeded Grizzlies team that was led by a second-year Ja Morant, really no business winning that series, and then back in his rookie season, you have to go back to when he beat Russell Westbrook and Paul George in the first round when they were on Oklahoma City, which, of course, you could say that was probably an impressive series win, but in retrospect, when you look at what Russ and George have done in their playoff careers since, you start to be like, oh, well, that makes a little sense. And the point is he hasn't really beaten anybody that good in a playoff series before, and he still doesn't have a conference finals appearance, even in a weaker Eastern Conference now with three opportunities and some series that he certainly had a chance to win. They were pretty decent favorites in this one. But like I said, when you're playing that way, and that's always been the worry with Mitchell, is that he has bad habits that he reverts to, and they're almost Russell Westbrook-esque. I'm not going to say he's Russ, because he's still more efficient, a slightly better decision maker, better shooter. But a lot of the things we shit on Russ for are the same things that Mitchell falls into, and I think that's a big reason why. So I'm not here to label Mitchell as some loser or anything like that. I'm just saying that if he gets into his 30s and we still don't have that conference finals, then we're going to maybe start to have a little bit of a discussion about why every other player of this era, except for Embiid, has, and he's really the only one who hasn't gotten there. So, but for Cleveland, the thing is, the East is going to be so wide open next year. You just take Boston out of the picture, there's a really good chance that Giannis is not on the Bucks next year. If he goes to the West, then the top two picks in the draft went to Western teams. Like the East, it's going to be bleak. If you basically completely remove Milwaukee and Boston out of the contenders, what does that leave you with? Cleveland, the Knicks, the Pacers, maybe the Magic if they make some moves. Like it's wide open. It's up for grabs. So I think without that context, I would have probably sat here and said that I don't see how Cleveland can't make a move. I know they just won 64 games, like we've talked about all year, but the playoffs is where you really judge your team and where you see where you stand and what your flaws are. And So I probably would have been ready to say they need to maybe think about moving Allen or Garland or something like that. And I love both those guys. I think they're awesome players, and they're not guys that I typically would be like, yeah, get rid of them. But it's really the only move they have. They're already deep into the second apron going into next year, regardless of any move that they make. They only have one tradable first, which will happen after the draft. They have two other swappable first, 5 seconds over the next 7 years. But even before they re-sign a Ty Jerome, for example, they are in the second apron. They don't have a pick in this year's draft. So there's very limited flexibility. They're not really going to be able to add any impact players unless they trade Garland or Allen or both. So that's really the only move. But the thing is, like, with the East the way it is, I almost am now inclined to be like, maybe just run it back. Give it one more year with the core and see, just because if you're Cleveland's front office, you could sit here and be like, well, we weren't healthy. We would have beaten Indiana. We could have beaten New York if we played them and we were healthy too. And without Boston around next season as a contender, with Giannis maybe out of the conference, why can't we win the East? And I think that's a explainable argument. I can't sit here and say that that's completely not sound logic, like, or anything like that. But I think if they're really looking in the mirror and really want to have a reality check, I think deep down they know that this core is just not a championship level core as currently constructed. I think they have four really, really good players that maybe don't perfectly fit next to each other very well. I think they would be well served adding a bigger wing that can create some offense a little bit more, that can be a two-way guy for them. And maybe, I think Mobley probably, if we're being honest, should be a center. I think that's going to be his long-term, more natural position. And so that just creates an awkward situation when you've got Allen and then you've got two small guards in the backcourt that can get picked on defensively without that sort of perimeter stopper on the defensive end on the roster currently. And so I think you might have to trade from your strengths in Allen or Garland to maybe balance the roster a little bit more. So that would be my honest advice to them, but I totally get why you'd run it back, just because the East is going to be awful. It's going to be so bad. It's going to be maybe the worst conference we've had in a long time, and the West is going to be maybe the best conference we've had in a long time, which is saying something, because the East hasn't been very good anyway. But I think it could make sense to run it back one more year. But if they fall short again next year, then I don't know what else to say. The writing's been on the wall for multiple years now, and I think it's time for them to at least consider looking around at the market and seeing what those guys could get them. And then the last series we had was the Timberwolves and Warriors, which I picked the Timberwolves in five, which is exactly what happened. But, you know, I think it's a little unfair to say that the series could have maybe played out a little differently if not for the Steph Curry injury, because going into the game one, the Warriors looked like the better team. I mean, I know they win that game, but they had the Wolves in hell defensively. They were, you know, getting decent shots on the offensive end. Steph was cooking in the first half. So it definitely had me second guessing the pick a little bit. Like, maybe I'd underestimated Golden State, but the Steph injury obviously just had them dead in the water. This team is so Steph reliant, and it's not just the scoring that he brings and the shots that he gets, but the gravity he creates for everybody else. You know, when everyone moves up a slot in the pecking order, it has such a massive ripple effect, especially for a team like this, that just their number one weakness is just shot creation and the ability to generate looks on the offensive end, which they rely so heavily on Steph for. And so they just didn't have enough offensively. And I don't think it's surprising. I thought they did enough defensively to win this series. I mean, the Wolves didn't go crazy on that end of the court, but 106 offensive rating collectively for the Warriors in this, that's just not going to get it done. You're not going to win a lot of playoff series with that. And I think the person this falls the most on is Jimmy Butler, because I said this going into the postseason that I thought they could make a run if they got a playoff Jimmy performance, the vintage Miami Heat Jimmy Butler, who was averaging, you know, 25 to 30 points per game and carrying undermanned, not that talented Miami Heat teams to the NBA finals. But I just think at this point, I don't think he can carry a team like that anymore. He's in his mid to late 30s, and he's just past the point where that's something he can do. I don't think it's something he really wants to do either, which is why he wanted to get out of Miami, aside from just the money part of it. But for this series, I mean, he averaged 27-6, which, you know, is fine. It's not bad numbers, but 43% from the field, not great. 30% from three, not great. He was fine in game one and game two, 20-11-8 near triple double in game one, and then 17-7-4 in game two. And then game three, that was like his one, all right, I'm going to carry the team to a win tonight game. He had 33-7-7, and it looked like they had that one in the bag, but they did blow it down the stretch. He went only 1-for-7 in the fourth quarter, so it feels like he really ran out of gas there. And then after that, he just was not aggressive enough. You know, with Steph out, he needed to be the guy. Like, he needed to be taking 20-plus shots every single game with Steph out. And instead, 9 shot attempts in game four, 11 in game five. That's just not going to get it done. He had 9 total field goals made in those last two games. And they just needed him to do more than that. And he has been kind of tentative as a scorer throughout the last couple seasons. He hasn't averaged 25 plus points per game since the first round of the 2023 run against the Bucks. He did average 38 in that series. But since then, he hasn't averaged 25 plus. And in the 6 series before that series, he averaged 25 plus in 5 out of the 6 previous ones. So he was doing that regularly, averaging 27 points per game total over that span. And now he's not even sniffing that in a single series at this point. And so I just don't think he can be the guy that carries the team anymore. I think he's got to be the secondary or even tertiary option at this point. He's not a number one. He was kind of overqualified for that in the past anyway, but the results had been there, so it's hard to argue. But yeah, Jimmy just, he was disappointing, and he's older, and I think that he's more of just a situational scorer at this point, and he still is a really good defensive player. He still is a really good playmaker. He gets to the line. He does a lot of things that help winning, but scoring 25 points per game on a nightly basis in the postseason just isn't one of them. And that's kind of what they needed. And because beside from him, they were relying on guys like Buddy Hield, Brandon Pajemski, that to be their consistent creators. And that's just a recipe for disaster. I mean, I love Pods as much as anybody, maybe more than anybody, but he's just not built for that role right now, especially not in the playoffs. He shot only 34% from the field in this one. Buddy Hield shot only 36% from the field in this one. He was 8-for-29 from two-point range. So when he tried to generate things, it just did not go well. Moody was just unplayable in this, under 4 points a game on 22% from the field, 4-for-18. In the series. Like, I don't know what happened to him. He had been a starter for them for months and just completely fell off a cliff. Kerr was just throwing shit at the wall at the end of this, seeing what stuck. I mean, he had 12 guys that played in at least 4 of the 5 games. So just emptying that bench to see who could give him something out there. And the only thing that really stuck was Jonathan Kuminga, who was pretty much out of the rotation by the end of the regular season and in the first round as well. But he was up and down. I mean, he averaged 20 points, but only 1 assist per game. So just very black hole-y. He shot the ball well, 6 total assists across the 5 games. Just not someone that was really generating offense, but just throwing shots up and they were going in. Kind of felt like empty points. And the team was 0-7 in the playoffs when he played 20 or more minutes. So it just felt like they threw him out there because at least he could score, but he wasn't really impacting the game as much as you would have hoped. And so this Warriors team, I don't even think they probably make the playoffs without Steph. I just don't think they have the talent offensively to be able to compete, but especially not against a team like Minnesota. So I know that's a lot of sort of excuses, but Minnesota still, you know, they deserved to win this series. They are a worthy conference finalist. They've looked really good in the playoffs to this point. And the role guys, it's not like they were anything too special in this game, but they have been a two-headed monster with Ant and Randall so far in this postseason. I mean, Ant, 26-8-6, was taking over games late when it mattered most. Game one, he started inexplicably 0-of-10 from the field, But he went 47 for 89 from that point on in the series, 53% the rest of the way. So he really did play super well offensively after that just kind of out of nowhere bizarre start to game one. He had 28 points in the second half of game three, which was kind of the swing game. If Golden State had found a way to win that one with the big Butler and Kuminga performances, then maybe Steph could have come back for game six and they could have had a chance. But because Minnesota was able to right the storm and come back and win that one led by Ant, that really is kind of what decided the series. He was 44% from three during this series and he had 12 assists in the game five closeout. So really nice just all around performance from Ant, which is kind of what we've come to expect from him in the postseason over the last few years. But what we have not come to expect is just the dominance that we've seen out of Julius Randle. It seems like he has potentially exercised his playoff demons because he's playing the best basketball of his career. He averaged 25-7-7 on 53% in this series. In the playoffs overall, he's averaging 24-6-6 on 51%. In this series, they were a plus 9.2 when he was on the court, only a plus 0.8 when he was off. So they were way better when he was out there. They are 30-6 in the last 36 games that he's played. And this is, again, after his playoff stints with the Knicks, where he shot 34% from the field, 28% from three, had more turnovers than assists. He was just the poster boy for playoff, the opposite of playoff riser, playoff sinker, I guess we'll call him. But he's just been great. There's no way around it. His size, strength, physicality has been an issue. I think it's been nice for him to get to play back-to-back teams that are pretty undersized. The Lakers obviously don't really have a viable starting center. The Warriors don't really either. They just play Draymond Green there. But hey, he dominated Draymond in this series. And so he's been able to take advantage with his size and strength and just score at will. And so credit to him. They haven't really been totally challenged in this playoffs yet. It feels kind of weird to say they're already in the conference finals. But a big part of that is him. If he plays how he played with the Knicks, I don't even know if they're in this position to this point. And so credit to him. He's been the number one reason, outside of obviously Ant's just consistent brilliance, that they're even here. And I think that their size with Gobert and Reed really bothered the Warriors, just like it did the Lakers. I throw Randle in there too. But Gobert has not had like super flashy stats, but his impact as a just defender, rebounder has been felt. I mean, we saw what he did in the close of that game against the Lakers. He just has been a mismatch for the other teams because of his sheer size, and it has bothered these teams. And so they just continue to trot out maybe the most rock solid top eight in the league right now. I will say this, it would have been shocking if this series made it to six or seven without Steph. So the Wolves deserve credit because they took care of business, but I don't think there's too much to take away from this series, because I think, like I said, the Warriors without Steph, I think maybe the weakest playoff team in the field without him, and not a team that's really a playoff caliber team. And so it's hard to say like, oh, I feel great about Minnesota after this. I feel about the same that I felt, because I think they're a really good team, but yeah, they didn't like prove anything to me in this, because it just wasn't a really fair litmus test. But they are every bit deserving of conference finals, like I mentioned. And I think the Lakers series is still in top of mind for me, because they dominated that series in a way that I didn't think they would. But for the Warriors, their future is, you know, murky at best. They are probably one big piece or two medium-sized pieces away from really being interesting as a contender. I think they definitely need to add a more reliable big man. I don't think they can have Looney and Post as their only guys they can throw out there, Trace Jackson Davis or whoever. You know, it's just by committee, and then Draymond's playing five most of the time. I really would have liked if they had went and got like Vucevic at the deadline. I think he would have been just a times five X on what Quentin Post brings to them as a floor spacer, but he's much better inside. Not the best defender, but still, just give them another option. Give them a little bit of size, bigger body. He's a good rebounder too, and it probably wouldn't have been kind of cheap. They've been linked to Brook Lopez a little bit already. I think that would be a good match too, but again, another really old guy with Draymond, Steph, and Jimmy, all 35 plus, that just add a fourth guy to that core that's 35 plus. I think I'd rather go a little younger, but I know that he'll be cheap, so I understand that. But I think they definitely need to add a big. I think that a Kuminga sign and trade is likely. I don't think that he's a very good fit on this team, and he obviously was not in the rotation for big chunks down the stretch, really only played late due to necessity. So I think it's probably better for both parties to move on. They maybe would have been smart to have moved him before his value maybe tanked a little bit, but at least he showed some flashes in the postseason where they can maybe get something for him. But I really think they need, aside from just a big man, another semi-reliable wing or creator, or even a guard, you know, someone next to Steph. Like, it could be someone like, even, I don't know if he'll end up getting traded. I talked about this at Boston a little bit, but someone like a Derek White could be really good for them. You know, another guy just to take pressure off Steph as a ball handler and as a shooter and a scorer next to Jimmy as well. I think that'd be a great fit alongside a big. I think a big is a must, but I think a guy like that would also be a really nice ass. But I don't know how, if they're really ever going to get back to being true contenders. If you add Vucevic and a Derek White, are they closer? For sure. For sure. But am I going to pick them over Oklahoma City in that scenario? Still probably not. Am I going to pick them over Minnesota, or if the Lakers, when they add a center, like, or Houston, if they make a big deal for like KD? I mean, it took them 7 games just to beat Houston without like a top scorer. So I don't know. I don't know. But could they find themselves back in the conference finals at some point? Sure, maybe. But it's probably just going to be one of those scenarios where they're just pretty good riding into the sunset. Whenever those guys leave, it could get pretty ugly. And I think that was what really was highlighted in this series for them, is that life after Steph is not going to be as awesome as you think it is. And that could be a reason why they're being conservative with moving some of their picks, because they know that they're going to need those things, because yeah, they don't have enough right now. And I'd like to see them add another piece or two, like I said, but again, I don't know if a piece is out there that could really move the needle for them, but we will see how that goes. They have all their picks, they have movable contracts, so it's certainly possible for them to potentially swing a move. Okay, so now I'm going to go through the two conference finals that we've got coming up this week. I'm going to start in the East with the Knicks and Pacers, and I just want to say I'm very excited for this series. Last year when they played, it was a really fun series, but it was kind of cut short just because of a lot of the injuries for New York. And both these teams look a lot different, in my opinion. Yeah, obviously, the Knicks have some personnel changes. I think Towns is by far the biggest wild card, that they just didn't have a guy like that last year, because Randle didn't even play in that series at all either. And then Mitchell Robinson was out, and then OG got hurt, and then Brunson was out in Game 7. But that game was probably already over in Game 7 anyway. So, but Indiana, a lot of the same personnel, but in some ways that's good. I think they've got more experience, more continuity, just to feel confident that they can beat these guys. They beat them last year. They won a Game 7 in Madison Square Garden last year. If that doesn't build your confidence against a team, then I'm not really sure what will. So I think they can win, but also I think they're way better defensively than they were last year. Last year they were bottom half of the league. This year they've been top 10 for really the majority of the season. And so I think that's a big difference maker for Indiana. And really the biggest question marks for me are, how can the Knicks slow down the Pacers offense? Because they've just been kind of a mismatch for everyone they've played. They're very unique. They're not like Boston. They're harder to guard. You know, they won't fall for the trap of matchup hunting or isolations to try to attack those matchups like Boston did. The way they attack their matchups is unique. They do it with ball movement and collapsing the defense. And so I don't think it's going to be as easy of an assignment, which is crazy to say out loud that Boston was the easy assignment just with how good they've been. But I think Indiana is just so different offensively, not relying on one guy. They don't play isolation, that they're just hard to guard. And when you've got like good defenders like OG Anunoby and Mikal Bridges, it's a little harder for those guys to have a huge impact, because they're not doing a lot of one-on-one guarding. It's guarding that you got to have a really good team defense to stop Indiana. And I'm not saying New York doesn't. I'm just saying it's a different look from what they've seen. And just for example, I mean, the Pacers had 124 offensive rating versus the Knicks last year. Again, I know that they had a lot of injuries and stuff, but they broke the playoff record for shooting percentage in Game 7 last year, 67% from the field. They shot 53% as a team, 43% as a team. So, I mean, their efficiency was off the charts in that series. I know health was a factor, but I'm just saying that the Knicks certainly don't have much to take from last series in terms of like, oh, well, we did this and it worked well for us, because not much of their defense worked well for them last year in this series. And in terms of who's guarding who, you know, I think Bridges probably starts on Halliburton with Anunoby on Siakam. But again, I think just the way that Indiana moves the ball, I don't know if individual matchups are as important for them as they might be for another team. And I think that they've got a lot of guys that can attack. Like, fine, you want to put Brunson on Nembhard? I think Nembhard can attack him really well. We've seen that in the past. Nesmith can attack off the swing and pump fake, drive to the basket and make an extra pass or something like that. And then Turner is a nice pick and pop option. You know, I think a lot of the reason why Boston had been really good against New York in the past is because their five out look, and it put Towns in some awkward situations. But that wasn't really a thing because Porzingis struggled so much. But Turner's been playing great over the last two postseasons. So I think he, not as good of a player as Porzingis, but can stretch the floor in a similar manner. And I think that could make it, again, tougher for New York to guard them. Another thing is this series is going to come down to who plays better in clutch time, because both these teams have been great so far. The Pacers are plus 54 in clutch time in the playoffs. The Knicks are plus 26. So they've dominated both of these teams. They both had some insane comebacks, and they both have played their best in the biggest moments of these fourth quarters. And so I have no doubt that we're going to have some close games. And so whoever wins those swing games, which I know that sounds obvious, but both these teams, given that they are good clutch time teams, one of them is going to have to, you know, outplay the other one. And I think that's going to be a big factor in who wins this series as well. I think for the Knicks, they obviously have a short rotation. They're playing basically only seven guys. Can that be sustained? Can their health hold up? They've been very, very healthy this season across the board, other than Mitchell Robinson, who missed a huge chunk of the season. Then Brunson missed some time at the end of the year, but they pretty much already clinched a top three seed at that point, so it really wasn't a big deal. But I mean, Mitchell Robinson, since coming back, has been this is one of the longest stretches he's played in a while. OG Anunoby's had maybe his healthiest season in years. And so they've got some injury-prone guys that have been able to stay healthy. So can they stay healthy? Can they continue to play big minutes with only seven dudes as we go down the stretch of this playoff run for them? That's going to be a question mark for me as well. I think that because of their short rotation, their margin for error is a lot smaller than Indiana's. Like, if Anunoby or Mitch Robinson tweak something, I think that could decide the series right there. Anunoby misses two games. I think that that is enough of an impact to swing this series towards Indiana in a considerable fashion. So that's going to be a question mark for me. You never want to project injury, but you also want to look at the track record for these guys. And the Knicks have been healthy and they play big minutes because that's what Tibbs does. And we're getting deeper into this season. And the deeper you go, the more likely someone could get hurt. Another thing is who guards Brunson. Last year, they started with Nembhard on him and he got toasted. I know Nembhard's been their main guy on opposing ball handlers and guards, but I think they really need to go with Nesmith, because once they made that switch last year, it was a lot harder on Brunson. And Nesmith just, it, for whatever reason, was just a tougher guard for him. And Nembhard just, he was getting cooked. And I think Nembhard's a good defender, but sometimes matchups are just weird and certain guys are just able to do better against other guys. And so I think Nesmith has to be the guy. I would put Nembhard on, you know, Bridges or Hart or Bridges or whoever. But I think Nesmith, he is best suited to slow down Brunson as he did a little bit last year, a little bit more size. And I think that's the matchup they need to go with. So I'm going to be very much interested in game one, who lines up against Brunson. And hopefully Carlisle learns from his, I won't say mistake. I mean, it made sense they started with Nembhard on him, but because they already made that adjustment in series last time, I wonder if they'll just go straight to it instead of trying to like start with Nembhard and pivot if they need to. I don't see why they would do it that way, but you never know. Another question is, can Towns be the mismatch that he should be? He has not been great in the postseason. In the regular season, he was 24 points, 14 rebounds, 53% from the field, 42% from three. In the playoffs, he's only down to 20 points, 11 rebounds, 48% from the field, and 34% from three. He was only 3-for-19 from three in the Boston series. So for all the greatest shooting big of all time talk that he has, he didn't shoot much from outside, like at all. He just didn't. And I don't know if that was something with the schemes Boston was doing. Maybe he just wanted to live in the paint a little bit more. But I think he is like the one thing that gives New York sort of an advantage in terms of that's just a layer that they did not have last year offensively against Indiana. And so Towns needs to take advantage. We'll see if he can do so. But that's another question I have. And I think this series is just going to be really hard to pick. I think both of these teams have a clear identity. They know who they are. They know how they want to play. Knicks want to slow it down and play in the half court. Pacers like to play with pace and get the ball up the court, ball movement, player movement. Knicks are a little bit more matchup attacking and manipulating the defense with one or two guys. So it's contrasting styles. It was fun seven games last year. I think I'm going to go Knicks in seven, but I do not feel good about it. I just think that the Knicks, if they maintain their health, they're slightly more talented at the top. And the Pacers, they've shot 50% or better and 40% better from three collectively over the last two postseasons. And I just wonder how long can that maintain? I think that they just are a great offensive team, so they're going to score in this series. But if they don't hit those sort of numbers, then I worry if maybe the Knicks will have an advantage, because I think they can muck the game up a little bit more than Indiana can. But the thing is, the Pacers have been unmuck-upable really over the last few years. So it's really hard. I've gone back and forth. I feel like whoever I pick is the other team's going to win. So I am going to go with Knicks in seven, but again, I don't feel good about it. I think Indiana absolutely can win this series. Absolutely can. I think it is a total toss-up, and no outcome will surprise me, because I think they're both really, really good teams. And I just think that the Knicks, when it's really hard like this, I normally default to the star power at the top, who's got more of it. And I think the Knicks have a little bit more, but again, it really could go either way. And then moving out west, we've got Thunder and Wolves, and this is going to be another really fun series. Oklahoma City's obviously been the best team all season long, not only in the Western Conference, but also in the NBA as well. But the Wolves have played them really well. You know, their games have all been competitive this year. I don't think that they're intimidated by Oklahoma City. They were in the spot last year in the Western Conference Finals. They've got more experience than OKC, despite also being a bit of a young team. They've got size to match up with OKC. They've got bodies to throw at SGA. And so one of the first things that I'll be looking for and kind of questions I have for this series is the Randle piece, because he's been the X factor in these first two series, but this is a really different look because they play two really small, undersized teams in the first two rounds, and OKC is not that. Last year they were, but after adding Hartenstein and their two big look, like, they've got options there now. And so my question is, who's going to guard Randle? Do they put Chet on him with Hartenstein on Gobert? That would probably be the more traditional look, but Chet's a little, you know, frailer, a little less strong than you maybe would like for somebody who's guarding Randle, because that's kind of been his strength, especially in this postseason. So then do they go five out and put Chet on Gobert and maybe have Jalen Williams guard Randle? Or do they put Caruso into the starting lineup and have him guard Randle, which normally would sound silly, but we just saw him do a really good job on Jokic. So I think where I'm at, I might try the Caruso thing out. I just think he's really good at guarding bigger players, and I think that that's a matchup that I'm willing to at least experiment with right there. I don't think Chet is really a great fit for that, but I also don't really want to put Hartenstein on him because he's probably a little slower footed. You could try that out. But I think J-Dub also is an option. So they've got some options, but it'll be interesting to see who guards him, because he has been the X factor, like I mentioned. And will he continue to dominate how he has, or will we see flashes of New York Knicks playoff Julius Randle? I think that's going to be a really important deciding factor for this matchup. Another thing is, how do the Wolves play without their clear size advantage? Like I mentioned, that's really been how they've dismantled these teams so far in the postseason, is their size and being able to lean back on that. Whereas they're just not going to have that advantage against Oklahoma City, because they can deploy the two big lineup that's super effective. They're going to have a 7-footer out there basically at all times. So I just don't think that that's going to be the advantage that it's been for them. And so I'm just interested to see how Minnesota looks without that clear advantage, because it's going to be a different look from what they've seen. Another one is, can J-Dub play with any consistency? And can they survive if he doesn't? Because I already watched through his shooting splits from the last game or from the last series. He wasn't great in the playoffs last year either after the first round. And so it's his first time in the conference finals. If Randle is dropping 20, 25 a night and he's efficient in doing so, that's going to be 50 to 60 points every single night from Ant and Randle that they're getting. If Shea's dropping 30, who's getting that 20 every night? Do they have a guy that can match those guys? And so I think just given how good Randle has been, someone on OKC is going to have to match him from a production standpoint if they want to comfortably win this series. And so maybe it's Chet, maybe it's J-Dub. Regardless, the Wolves are a lot deeper than the Nuggets, for example. So the Thunder are not going to get by on just winning from depth like they've done in the past necessarily. The Wolves have role guys that can match the play of the Thunder. So I think that makes that number two matchup so much more important because Ant and SGA are going to go at it. The role guys are going to be, I mean, probably a little up and down because that's what role players are, but relatively consistent for both sides. So the number two, J-Dub and Randle, is going to be a big thing for me. And then I think one thing OKC might do that we might see more of this series is go more five out because they kind of abandoned that against Denver with Jokic, but I don't think that that's going to be much of an issue. I don't think they're going to be so concerned about Rudy Gobert on offense, but obviously that'll spread the floor a little bit and it's going to pull Gobert out of the paint, which Golden State and LA, I think, tried to do that a little bit, but because they had no actual size when they were doing it, it just, the pros of doing it didn't outweigh the cons. Whereas OKC can still have a 7-footer out there on the court when they're also spreading the court out with all five guys on offense. So it's just another look that I think Minnesota really hasn't seen. Other teams were having to pick their poison. Let's play a big who can't shoot, or let's just play no big, basically. Whereas OKC has the ability to play a big who also can't shoot. And so I think that we'll see a little bit more of that after they kind of abandoned that against Denver. But I think that was a Jokic-specific thing. And then lastly, who will be the best player in this series? SGA has been the better player this year. He's probably going to win the MVP, but Ant has been a spectacular postseason performer. He was a viable candidate for first-team All-NBA this season, in my opinion. And he goes in every series thinking he's going to be the best guy. I mean, the guy took down KD last year. He took down Jokic last year. He took down Luka this year. He took down, well, I was going to say Steph, but I guess that's not fair. But the guy's been a killer against the top guys. And he's won the matchups against these guys in most, pretty much all these series. And so if Ant thoroughly outplays SGA, then I think that's big advantage Wolves. But I think ultimately this is going to be pretty even. You know, I think they're both going to get their points. I think they're both going to be really good because that's just what they've both been. And so that's why I think this is an interesting discussion, but I think the secondary guys are really what's going to swing this more so. But ultimately, I'm going to pick the Thunder in six games. I think it'll be competitive. I do think the Thunder are just a better team though. I've been on them all year. I'll say this. I'm going to keep saying this every round. Like, this is a historically good defense, a really, really good team across the board. Their biggest question mark is just who can score 22 points a night next to Shea. And I think they've just got enough by committee to be able to continue to get through these series. I'm not saying it won't ever come back to bite them. It very well may, but I just think that Oklahoma City is so suffocating defensively. They can just lean into that and continue to win that way. Like, for example, they just had to make a decision between five out to be better offensively, but maybe not guard Jokic as well, or have the two bigs to guard Jokic and maybe suffer a little bit offensively. And they just leaned into their defense because that's their identity. And I think they're going to keep doing that. And they're going to keep winning the turnover battle. And they're going to keep having these perimeter scorers just getting hounded by all these guards and wings that they have to throw at them. And I think both of these teams are really good, though. I think both would be worthy NBA finalists. But I think this is just Oklahoma City's year. And I think that they're the best team remaining. And it's not a knock on the Wolves. I just think OKC really is that good. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Thank you so much for listening. As I said, conference finals are set to kick off tomorrow night. So very excited to watch those games. I think they're both going to be two awesome series, four really fun teams that all
feel like they could maybe be competitive or maybe even beat any of the other ones. You know, we've got a lot of parity in the league, as I mentioned, and it's cool to see. So I'll be doing a mid-series check-in after game two or game three of each of these series. We'll see from that point on. And then obviously we'll recap the series when they wrap up and then talk all things NBA Finals once we get to that point. But with that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.